If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today you'll be hearing some unexpected stories from the history of Ireland, courtesy of the author Turtle Bunbury. Earlier this year, Turtle published Ireland's Forgotten Past, a colourful collection of 36 lesser-known moments from the nation's history. I called him to find out more. Your book is a somewhat whimsical journey through 36 snapshots from Irish history. What captured your imagination about these stories in particular?
Well, I live now, where I'm looking out is the glorious green Irish countryside, sun-dappled today. And I live very close to the foot of the Wicklow Mountains. I can see County Wexford, where the Normans and the Vikings once held power. And I've always been, you know, very fascinated by all the history of the landscape that surrounds me. Right over through my window, I can see an overgrown ring fort covered in primroses and bluebells. But, you know, that was once home to maybe 7 or 8 families, I'm told. Then there's a little stream that flows down there towards an ancient monastery. I mean, it's practically gone at this point. The monastery is so ancient. But there's a lane there and there's a little weir. And then across a couple of fields from that is a dolmen, you know, one of those portal tombs that was built 5,000 years ago. So you're surrounded by this stuff. And also what kind of triggered it for this book in a way was just behind the dolmen is a barley field. And that barley field, somebody sent a drone over it in the beautiful long hot summer of 2018. And it suddenly turned out that barley field was full of ancient barrows and ring ditches and circular enclosures, you know, as were being revealed all across these islands during that summer. And it just struck me that, you know, there are so many secrets that are locked up in our landscape. And that's something that I've always felt a deep, you know, affinity with, that every field and hill and stream and, you know, rock is certainly in Ireland. I'm sure it's the same across, you know, many countries. But in Ireland, they're all sort of offer you little clues into our past. So that's what I was trying to explore.
That leads me on very nicely to my next question, which is, as became very clear in your first answer, landscape is an incredibly important part of the stories that you tell in the book. As well as all these ones just within your local area, what do you think are some of the must-see historical sites or historic landscapes for visitors to Ireland?
Well, I mean, we've got very blasé about them at this stage, and we just drive past them without realising that over there on top of those mountains are amazing, again, you know, stone circles or ancient forts or primeval forests or whatever it is. But certainly in any of the mountainy parts of Ireland, any hill in Ireland, you can climb up there and you're pretty sure you're going to find something from the Neolithic period, particularly in the remotest parts of Ireland. So, you know, that is pretty extraordinary in itself. One of the places I visited was Slieve Gullion, which is this volcano that collapsed millions and millions of years ago. And very few people in Ireland would be aware that there was ever a volcano in Ireland. But actually, we all drive through it all the time. It's on the main Belfast to Dublin road goes through it. And it's this fascinating landscape around there that is right on the Louth-Armagh border, the Northern Irish border with the South. So, and there's ring forts on top of that, too. In fact, the highest passage grave in Ireland is at the very top of it. So that is another area of great beauty. But I'm afraid to say I think we're very blessed in Ireland, because nearly every which way you look, there is something, of a historical nature for people. So many ruined castles and ring forts and things like that everywhere.
It sounds fantastic. You mentioned earlier that these stories, many of them have been forgotten. How did you go about rediscovering them and collecting them all?
Well, I mean, I was looking at different things. I mean, some of the stories are stories that have entertained me over the years about characters or events that are just so odd that I felt it was high time that they came to light again. Others are things that are slightly more complicated. They're about people who've just been sort of left out. And I use the word, the subtitle of the book is a history of the overlooked and disremembered. And I know disremembered is a kind of made up word, but I think I was trying to find a word for something that means it's been deliberately forgotten, and disremembered seem to sort of, you know, cover that. But there are aspects of our history, just like in any country's history, where people choose not to remember it. And in Ireland, for instance, if you picked up most 20th century history books written in Ireland, you're not really going to find much reference to the hundreds of thousands of Irish who served loyally with the British Empire, you know, the forces with the British Army or the Royal Navy or so forth, you know, because that didn't really fit with the narrative. Or another example would be royal visits. I mean, George IV, Queen Victoria, Edward VII, they all made successful visits to Ireland. But again, you wouldn't really find that story told very much in the Irish narrative. That's not to say this isn't an apologia for Ireland's royal past or anything, but I just thought it was very important to address those matters.
Yeah, so who are some of the characters from Irish history that captured your imagination?
Well, I think one of the earliest ones I fell in love with to an extent is Sitric Silkbeard. And I fell in love with his name because I'm not sure he'd have been that desirable a character. He was a Viking warlord and anyway, a fairly hefty character. He was king of Dublin for 46 years and pretty remarkable. I think, you know, we often forget how much influence the Vikings had over us in Ireland. It's emerged recently that a lot of us have it in our DNA, a lot more people than we thought. But they were dominant here for the guts of 400 years. So, you know, there's a big legacy there. It's not just the names of the days of the week that they gave us. Dublin, of course, was one of a half dozen ports, is the wealthiest of all the ports that they founded by Norse Vikings or Ostmen, men of the East, as we call them. In 841 AD, and it became an extremely wealthy port on the Vikings' watch, mainly as a holding depot for slaves, it seems. That was one of its great trades, up around Dublin Castle, near Temple Bar, for anybody who knows Dublin. And this, the port city basically became the Kingdom of Dublin, and in 993 AD, it came into the hands of Sitric Silkbeard. His grandfather had been a pretty successful king of Dublin. His father had been a little less so. Dublin was actually invaded by the High King of Ireland when Sitric was a boy, and the city was burnt down and all the slaves were freed and a massive tax put on the Vikings themselves. And then Sitric's brother was the king before him, a guy with the great name of Glún Éireann, he was a roaring alcoholic, and he ruled for 9 years before he was murdered. And then Citric comes to the fore. And what I like about him, he's got a really interesting, a lot of things happen on his watch. He founds Ireland's first mint in Dublin, and every now and then coins from that mint turn up. They found some in Wales recently. He kickstarted the very first city wall, the stone wall around Dublin, that started on his watch. Christchurch Cathedral, which is a place that anybody going to Dublin really ought to visit. Again, that starts on his watch after a pretty fascinating pilgrimage he makes to Rome. And then he returns via Cologne in Germany, and he meets the Irish Benedictine community there. And that seems to have been the basis for building the very first timber and stone cathedral in Christchurch. So he's got all that going on.
You also talk about the island's connection to the Roman world. Shows that it was actually quite interconnected early on.
Yeah, very much. I mean, look, it is an island at the end of the day on the west coast of Europe. So yes, and even going back to the Neolithic times and the Bronze Age times, you're constantly seeing links to the Iberian Peninsula, to Portugal, to Spain, and deep into the Mediterranean. And of course, the Viking world being as extensive as it was, it's no surprise that, that connection between Dublin and all of Europe. I mean, Dublin itself is part of that sort of regional power block at that time that extended right up the west coast of Scotland and northern England. Occasionally takes in places like the Isle of Man, the Hebrides, the Orkneys, but it goes all the way up into Norway. And I know that plenty of metalwork has turned up in Viking graves, on the west coast of Norway from the time of Sitric, Silkbeard and earlier. That is possibly plunder, but more probably merchandise, they think now.
One of the chapter titles which I was quite surprised to read was the Knights Templar in Ireland, as I had no idea that they had even been active there. What can you tell us about that story?
Right. Well, I mean, the Knights Templar, it's always hard to resist the Knights Templar. For those who don't know, they were this very wealthy military order that had been founded in Jerusalem in 1119 to protect pilgrims who were being mugged and murdered by brigands and thugs on the roads leading into the holy city of Jerusalem, which was at that time under Norman control. And basically, this is the run-up to the Cambro-Norman invasion of Ireland 50 years later, in 1169. By that time, the Templars, they've got enormous financial clout, and they form the elite of the crusading armies. And when, so basically, in fact, it's May 1170, so 850 years ago, the Normans arrive in big numbers under Strongbow Richard de Clare, who's the Earl of Pembroke. And they bring, they change this country. They bring in chivalry and castles and feudalism and frogs and all those sort of things. Anyway, one of the very first adventurers to come is a guy called Robert Fitzstephen. And I'm pretty sure he was certainly a kinsman. And I think he was probably the father of a guy called Geoffrey Fitzstephen, who was the Grand Master of the Templars in England in the early 1180s. In the early 1180s, that's the same time that Henry II, who's the King of England, he gives the Knights Templar the Vills, that's the taxable settlements of Clontarf, which is just north of Dublin, and Crook in County Waterford. It's roughly about 1,200 acres. Before that, about 8 years before that, Henry II had actually had to come over to Ireland. The Normans had come over and been so successful in their conquest of the sunny southeast of Ireland that Henry was alarmed. He thought that they were maybe going to set up a rival kingdom to himself. So he came over with another huge force, something like 500 mounted knights, 4,000 archers and men-at-arms and so on. And he got all the Irish and the Normans to submit to him, all the main Irish kings and the Norman lords. And before he left, he granted the southern half of the Hook Peninsula in County Wexford to the Knights Templar. And that includes this very lucrative ferry crossing that goes to Waterford and various things. So they end up with these enormous estates, huge estates, maybe 13 or 14 preceptories or manors, all across Munster and Leinster. And right over into, they've got one, their most westerly stronghold is over in County Sligo by a place that's called today Temple House. And what we think is that these estates were basically to raise income from agriculture and rents to help fund the ongoing campaigns in the Holy Land. And definitely that what they were doing was they were converting the pasture lands into cornfields, into profitable cornfields. They were developing a cloth and wool industry, pretty modest, but they were also probably breeding horses. So quite a lot going on there. And the guys who were running them, running the estates, collecting the rents, appear to have been retired Knights Templar whose fighting days were behind them.
So it was essentially the breadbasket of their other operations.
It was certainly a breadbasket. I know that they had similar operations, you know, elsewhere across Europe, but definitely, you know, it's good. It was good land where they were improving the land, but definitely they were bringing in a lot of barley and wheat and making good money from it.
One of the key figures in this story is William Marshall. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, well, I mean, William Marshall, who's the greatest knight, as he was known, the Earl of Pembroke, Lord of Leinster, a fascinating guy all by himself. I'm sure you've covered him at length because he survived all the Plantagenet kings. He gets King John to the table for Magna Carta. He's the richest man in the British Isles, I think, when he dies. He is also the most powerful Anglo-Norman lord to come to Ireland, and he scores the ultimate bride in Isabel de Clare. I mentioned Strongbow earlier. She is the daughter of Strongbow, Richard de Clare, and his wife Aoife, who was the daughter of the King Dermot McMurrogh of Leinster. And what that basically means is that William Marshall ends up inheriting the Kingdom of Leinster, he and his wife Isabel, the Kingdom of Leinster, which is a huge chunk, the bottom right corner of Ireland. And their legacy is all over the place. They built castles and ports and towns and a fabulous lighthouse. And you can see the ruins of many of those things right now to this day. But William Marshall, of course, was buried as a Knight Templar when he died in 1219. So that, you know, reinforces that link. And just very quickly, one other point there is that just before him was a guy called Walter de Riddlesford. He was the first Grand Master of the Knights Templar in Ireland. He founded a Knight Templar base at Kilkay, about 20 kilometres from where I am now, near Castle Dermot. And he also had one built at Clontarf Castle, which was the headquarters of the Knights Templar in Ireland. So there are many, many connections going on.
So what happened when the order was wiped out?
Well, yeah, so you fast forward through to that ominous day, the original Friday the 13th, October 1307, when the Knights Templar were purged out of existence. And in Ireland, the order went over to Ireland as well to arrest them all. And there was only apparently 20 Knights Templar in Ireland at that time, but 14 of them were arrested and they're brought into St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. And there's quite detailed accounts of this four-month inquisition in which these guys are, you know, facing charges, 85 charges in total, of denying Christ and spitting on the cross and worshipping false idols and homosexuality. And in fact, that's, you know, the most controversial aspect of it is this guy called Henri Donnet, who had just taken office as Master of the Templars in Ireland 2 days before the arrests began. So I don't know what's going on there. But anyway, he was this very respected Templar veteran. He'd fought in Cyprus and Syria and places like that. But he was also a favourite of Jacques de Molay, he was the order's the Grand Master of the whole Knights Templar across Europe. And de Molay had already been subjected to vicious torture and confessed to various heresies. He'd go on to be burnt at the stake. But anyway, in Dublin, some of the witnesses suggested that Donnet and de Molay had engaged in sodomy. So that was certainly the source of a lot of tittle-tattle in Dublin at the time. But ultimately, they couldn't pin anything on them, on the Irish Templars at all. And I mean, it got ridiculous, the whole trial. But at the end of it all, everybody was let go. Even Danae was released on bail, although they did lose their lands.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And what you get is this incredible hurricane that roars across thousands of miles of unbroken Atlantic Ocean, gathering momentum. And it hit the West Coast with such power that the waves broke over the top of the cliffs of Moher.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down. And learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Moving forward a few hundred years now, because you do cover a vast span of time in the book, you take a look at one episode of history which revolves around Oliver Cromwell, who you call the most despised human in Irish history. But you take a slightly sideways look at this story through focusing on his tailor. Why did you decide to look at that aspect of the story?
Well, I think, I mean, that's the thing about history, isn't it? There's always surprise people who turn up. And Daniel Byrne who is, as I call him, Cromwell's tailor, is an extraordinary example of somebody who's being very opportunist at a time like the Cromwellian conquest of Ireland. And he's unlikely because he is actually his ancestry. He's one of the O'Byrnes of the Wicklow Mountains, this fearsome tribe who lived up in the Wicklow Mountains and caused chaos to Dublin Castle for many centuries. His great-grandfather was this guy called Fiach MacHugh O'Byrne, who was the arch-nemesis of Queen Elizabeth and her Tudor administration in Dublin. Daniel, shortly before Cromwell arrives, he's got a little tailor outfit going in Dublin City, and it's right beside Christchurch Cathedral. And he just spots the gap in the market. And before Cromwell is in Ireland for very long, contemporary records say that Daniel Byrne, he's bought himself an enormous amount of white cloth in Dublin. He has it dyed red, coloured red. And he has 40 tailors working under him, turning that white cloth dyed red into the red coats, the uniforms for Cromwell's army, which is, pretty amazing thing to have done. There were apparently 43,000 soldiers in Cromwell's army, and the contemporary records confirm. They say he made uniforms for 40,000 men.
As that story highlights, like many in the book, Ireland hasn't always had an easy relationship with England, but that is something that comes up again and again, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it has, like everybody, you sort of have disagreements with your neighbours to your left and to your right. And the Irish situation was further complicated by the whole conquest of Ireland, although it is just so complicated how that plays out, because we've already heard that the very first people to come to Ireland were French-speaking Normans from Wales. Before that we had the Vikings, who were all speaking whatever they were speaking. So it is so complicated. And all the way through the Middle Ages, all the different waves of people coming and going, and right through to the Tudor era, you know, a lot of the people who come over to Ireland in the reign of Queen Elizabeth are young men in their early 20s who are, again, trying to be opportunists, trying to see if they can get hold of a bit of land. It is very, very complicated. People change sides. There are always disputes within families themselves, which makes it very complicated to try and see where people's loyalties are. And as I say, there was a huge amount of people who played along with it, who went with Ireland as the second city of the British Empire, as it was for a period, played that game. You'll find huge numbers of Irish in the civil service, in the army, as I mentioned, in the navy. But of course, then you have the other side, and that is the people who are really getting a very poor deal out of it, particularly after the Battle of the Boyne, when the Protestant ascendancy came in and basically ruled for a couple of hundred years. You know, that British imperial government in reinforcing the Protestant status. And that's when you get that massive emigration to America and a lot more tragic stories besides.
As someone with a pretty good grasp over a vast swathe of Irish history, were there any episodes or stories that you were really surprised to learn about when you were researching the book?
Well, I think the era of the First World War, which I had come to light when I first started writing the book, but I hadn't quite realised how much the Irish were involved in that. And I thought it was pretty interesting. I tell a chapter in the book about some of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers who had an incredibly hard time on the Western Front during the same week that the Easter Rising was being fought in Dublin. And actually, you know, when all's said and done, more Irishmen died on the Western Front that week than died men, women and children in Dublin that same week. So that you know, greatly surprised me. But that's the joy of being in the world of history. You're always going to be surprised, I think, by the tales that come up. The other era that, you know, would come to the fore more and more is the Georgian age, because with the brilliance of the internet and being able to check through the old newspaper archives, you can really get tremendous stories out from the 18th century. And I think the Georgian age is always coming to life.
Talking about the Georgian age, well, just about, yes, sneaking into the right at the end of the Georgian age, you chronicle an episode, the Night of the Big Wind, a hurricane in 1839. What can you tell us about that?
Right, yes. So very, a remarkable, well, this is the most devastating storm in recorded Irish history. It came in at night, which made it more terrifying. It started slowly. I mean, I think the thing is, nowadays, we when a hurricane is coming, we've given it a cuddly name. We then watch it coming over, you know, days and days as it approaches, and that has its own level of fear. But for these guys, you know, they had no idea what was coming. And the early reports that you get from the west of Ireland is that it was extremely calm beforehand. And you could hear voices floating on the air between houses like a mile apart. And then the first raindrops start. And what you get is this incredible hurricane that roars across thousands of miles of unbroken Atlantic Ocean, gathering momentum. And it hit the West Coast with such power that the waves broke over the top of the cliffs of Moher. I don't know, but I mean, when you read contemporary accounts, the impression is certainly that if Ireland didn't have those magnificent cliffs forming a barrier along the West Coast, the entire country would have been engulfed by water. It was a very, very intense storm. There's wind, there's hail, there's lightning, and it went through the country, through the centre of the country, and destroying thatch roofs. Of course, a lot of the houses are thatch roofs or timber cabins, and shattering windows, annihilating farms, all the hayricks and fences, and you've got animals escaping everywhere. Chimneys, somebody produced a statistic that 4,846 chimneys were knocked off their perches that night. So there you go, that's a measure of it. And where I live in Carlow, very near Carlow town, it knocked a pinnacle off Carlow Cathedral and the solitary remaining chimney off Carlow Castle, an old Norman castle. The chimney went off that and hundreds of thousands of trees went down. Again, not far from where I am, a guy called Henry Bruin of Oak Park, who had a substantial estate covered in trees. He declared his woods to be as bald as the palm of my hand.
To circle around to something that you said earlier, you brought up the term in the subtitle of your book, disremembered. Why do you think that some of these stories have been, quote, disremembered? Maybe the answer is different for different stories.
Yes, I think the answer is different for different stories. I mean, it's what fits with the narrative to an extent. So as I say, it wouldn't have been very fashionable, I think, in the 20th century to have produced a book highlighting, I mean, it still wouldn't be in the 21st century in many quarters, to produce books that, you know, highlight the Irish involvement with the British Empire. You know, that's still something that people struggle with and understandably so in many ways. And again, again, you get other people who maybe don't want to be told that their ancestors made uniforms for Cromwell's army. There is, you know, it's a long time ago in terms of years, but not so much in terms of generations. And I think, you know, when you go back to the Tudor age, is it what, 10, 11 generations or something like that? So, you know, it's not that many people. And in Ireland, we have long memories. And, you know, I think that has its role to play in it.
I think my final question would be, what would you want readers to take away from your book?
I would like them to just have a fresh look at what's around them. I think that's it. And to particularly during such times when you can't go too far, if you can get any distance at all, just go and see the places that are around you. Because I think it's just when I see a ruin, I try to remind myself that in that ruin, there were once people living there, that there were once, you know, beautiful women looking out the windows and men stoking roaring fires and cooking stuff. And life was in there. And if you can try and figure out who those people were and what that was about, I think that just brings life. It just brings it all. It illuminates it, and it will improve your own life because you look over there and it enhances your imagination.
That was Turtle Bunbury. Turtle's book, Ireland's Forgotten Past, A History of the Overlooked and Disremembered, is available now from all good bookshops, published by Thames and Hudson. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow when Roland White will be talking about sea harriers in the Falklands.